Okay, this is talking with Professor Jesse Greenstein at his home in Pasadena on 22nd August 75. Now, can you just tell me very briefly where you got your degree and this sort of thing, and when you first heard about radio waves in this context?
I got my bachelor's at Harvard in 29 and master's in 30, and then because of the Worldwide Depression, returned to my family's business in New York City for 4 years. It was during these years, actually, that Jansky was working, and by some strange coincidence, I spent most of my summer holidays on the New Jersey seashore.
Incredible.
It's quite a week. And I visited, I knew nothing about Jansky, but I visited their large, long-distance radio telephony station, which was in the sand barrens of New Jersey, just inland from the seashore. I met my wife there, incidentally, in this time. The period then when the discovery was made, I know nothing about, except that the year I returned to Harvard, married and ready to get a PhD.
Which year was this now?
1934, a four-year gap for my master's. Jansky's work had appeared, and in addition, the general realization of the importance of interstellar matter in solid form and dust had sunk into astronomy.
Right.
As a result, my thesis work, which was going to be on the interstellar matter, the theory of scattering of light by small particles, and the effect of this on the color and brightness and numbers of stars in our galaxy, fundamentally connected with the structure of our galaxy, happened to be in an area in which the question of what the gas in space might be doing was a particular excitement and importance. So although my thesis, which involved mathematical computations of multiple scattering from small spherical and later ellipsoidal particles, which 14 years later led to the theory of interstellar polarization in magnetic fields, this, oddly enough, kept hovering on the edge of what was the gas in space like, and how could we find it? My thesis advisor, Bach, as you know, became interested in pioneering radio astronomy at Harvard, but on my oral examination in 37, I had a very interesting question from Harlow Shapley, who asked me how I could find neutral hydrogen in space.
Really?
Because he thought it would be interesting to know. And I said, well, we knew how to find ionized hydrogen in diffuse nebulae, but neutral hydrogen could never exist in excited levels, which we could detect in the optical region. But it is true that I did say, but it was just a far-out kind of dream, that in a sense, there must be continuity in the populations of the higher levels of the hydrogen atom with the ionized state. And in fact, in the Menzel notation, you wrote population numbers in terms of the number of ions. And so that since there were long wavelength transitions, it's conceivable that someday you would find them and they would be similar in intensity to the recombination emission of the ionized hydrogen, which was then well known. That was a very interesting lucky guess, but
right,
I had
right.
no idea at all about the 21 centimeter line, because
and you never worked out any of what the frequencies might be or anything?
Well, yes, I'll come to that. That was 10 years later, oddly enough, in a paper written at Yerkes, but nevertheless, it did occur as a possible extension by the classical, we call it the correspondence principle.
Right, right.
That anything you knew about the continuum, you knew about discrete transitions, and that they were similar in intensity.
Right.
Well, this free radiation, as we call it, or hyperbolic transition of Raumstrahlung of one kind or other, was sort of in the back of my mind. But that was about all at that time. Now, I've gone through 3 years at Harvard, in between Whipple and I, somehow, and I have no real memory of how this happened, got interested in the, there's a paper by Jansky, which was not in the usual electrical engineers. Which
in popular astronomy.
Yeah, maybe that's
right.
It.
Right.
And so as a result of that, Whipple, who was, I think, an instructor, and I, a graduate student, sort of sat down and tried to see how what we knew about interstellar dust might be relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was clear that if Jansky had found anything, he had found the center of our galaxy. And the center of our galaxy might be, and there was no reason not to expect it, might be a thermal radiator.
Mm-hmm.
And this stupid unit in which the early work was published, which was something like microvolts, ESU,
per
meter.
Right.
I hadn't, and with Fred Whipple, we had the vaguest idea what that meant,
right,
in sensible CGS units. So we thought, well, we'll at least take a look. Had we known how to turn microvolt per meter into equivalent temperature, we wouldn't have even started. And
but now, let me ask you, you were already thinking interstellar matter. You apparently...
Immediately. I mean, it couldn't be stars. I mean, it was clear it couldn't be stars. Well, one thing from my study of interstellar dust, you knew the temperature of interstellar dust was around the black body 3-degree radiation.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, it's not
right.
A coincidence. It's the same temperature. Next, that dust could not radiate with great efficiency at very long wavelengths by really scattering. Essentially, it's terribly inefficient radiator. And nevertheless, it would be interesting if you could heat dust up a lot hotter than 3 degrees. By the way, that 3-degree figure comes very simply from stellar statistics. What fraction of the sky is covered
right.
by stars? It's the 1/√ of the dilution, not 1/4√ of the dilution factor. So this, I think, we were too ignorant of radio frequency engineering to have an idea what we were trying to do. But there was a signal, and we thought we'd eventually get around to find out what it meant. And the paper that Whipple and I wrote, which is, I think, in the in the National Academy of Sciences,
right.
which was a terrific disappointment, came about because at that time Chandrasekhar and a Russian, Kosirev, who was a madman, as you know, still did good work, had developed the theory of the radiative equilibrium for large bodies in which the curvature of the layers has to be taken into account.
Mm-hmm.
In an ordinary stellar atmosphere, it's thin compared to a star.
Right.
The radius, and therefore the layers are temperature stratified. The temperature drops 20% or 30% from the reversing layer to the edge of the star. But in a large star, you would have a temperature gradient which was almost very limitless. And Cecilia, the push pains, pain then, and try to explain the spectra of supernovae as expanding shells with curvature, which would give a very non-black body spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So we developed this radiative transfer theory. I was interested in it. I knew less of the mathematics of it. It was all brand new. 1934, I think, the first papers on curved atmospheres appeared. And we got the dust up to, I think, about 800 degrees, if you assume there was dust in the galactic center, and that, like other galaxies, we had a very bright nucleus. And if you said, well, you put enough dust in so it was essentially completely absorbed, the dust would heat up And that was about the right number, though in fact very few dust clouds get up much above a few hundred degrees. At least it was way above 3 degrees.
Right.
And then we went to George Washington Pierce. Is this a story you've heard?
No.
Pierce?
No, I haven't.
You know who he is?
No.
G.W. Pierce was head of the electrical engineering lab, I think it was called Crufts Lab in Carmel. He was the only live electrical engineer, and he'd written a textbook on electromagnetic waves. And we tried to go through that, and they were all these stupid units. And we went to G.W. Pierce, and he sort of misunderstood what we said about the signal. And he said, gee, that's about, convert it to CGS by so-and-so. And so we got very excited because it was right. And our 800-degree radiation would have explained Vansky's observations. The only trouble was that we were wrong by whatever it is, the 300.
Oh, the 300 ohms.
Something for
impedance of free space.
Free space, yeah. Exactly. We hadn't put that in. Well, we were so excited and so ignorant that when we got this numerical coincidence, we got into public relations. I was a middle graduate student, and I think Fred Whipple was an instructor. It was going to be a big deal. We got the reporters, the Harvard Press Bureau, whatever it was called. We got in. And then just a day or so before the paper was to appear in its original form, we went to talk to Pierce again. And he said, you are crazy.
Are you saying the day before it was going to appear in Proceedings of the NAS?
No, before it was going to appear as a public relations release.
Oh, I see.
And the Boston Evening Transcript and the Boston this or that, the New York Times.
Right.
All of this, we were out by this incredible factor. We were actually out by more, it turned out. We had come close with the original version of it. But as you know, at long wavelengths, the temperature gets higher and higher.
Right.
And so we were just plain wrong. And then as they got it at other frequencies later, it was clear that we would have been infinitely wrong.
This was in 1936 or 37?
Well, the year before the paper finally appeared.
I see.
Fred got sick to his stomach. I felt pretty bad. And we stopped the press releases, but oddly enough, I think I have somewhere upstairs, an editorial in the Boston Evening Transcript said, two young astronomers tried to explain the mysteries of cosmic static. They were wrong by, let's say, 1,000, but at least it was a noble try.
Oh, really? I'd like to see
that. I have that somewhere. I think I have it here.
Great.
But it was sort of fun, and then, of course, we... Sick as we were, we went back through it and then realized that we had just not understood the problem. And one other thing we really hadn't understood is the concept of effective gain.
Mm-hmm.
You see, we'd taken the area as the area, or essentially of a wavelength, I think we took. And it was long wave. And it wasn't all that wrong.
Right.
But, of course, the effective...
It was really two wavelengths long and one
wavelength. Effective
area is probably something like 2 lambda squared.
Right? Yeah, all right. So there were other errors, and so that made the signal even weaker, isn't it? We just taken it as a wavelength. So by the time we finished, the very disappointing paper that eventually came out showed we were just plain unable to explain it now.
But now I'm curious why you wanted to make such a big deal of it. Did you know that Bell Labs had a big press release and all this thing?
By this time I'd read all of Jansky's papers and the IIEA and stuff like that. No, we'd gone into the surface thing professionally. The only thing that we had done non-professionally is not understand, I guess, it's MKS.
Right. But why...
You mean, why
the press release?
Well, because...
That wouldn't be a normal thing.
Well, actually, I guess it was probably because cosmic static was a rather romantic idea.
Mm-hmm.
The public was made romantic, and I think for a sensible young astronomer, and let's see, let's call it 36, I was 27.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of seeing anything about the center of our galaxy directly, which cosmic static was, as against the fact that my thesis work, for example, indicated that we would never see the center of our galaxy. We estimated the absorption in those days as about a magnitude per kiloparsec. Right. So we thought it'd be 10 magnitudes to the galactic center. Well, that's 10 to the minus fourth, nothing would come through. And nothing does until you get to the infrared, as we know. So all of this indicated that interstellar absorption blinded me, blinded the astronomer in optical wavelength to the center. Right. And here was this challenge that the only thing Jansky saw was the center.
Right, right.
You see, later, Reba saw what a Cygnus spiral arm as right. a first extra thing. But this was just plain irritating, you know, and when you're 27 and fairly competent, you think there is a kind of deep-bred irritation in your skin from then on, a sensitivity.
Right.
That here is something which we could not do, and nobody thought of anything but optical wavelengths.
And so you were really
somewhat
excited that you seemed to have solved the problem.
We had almost solved it, and yet, obviously, we were wrong.
But now the other question is, as you said, why did you and Whipple get interested in it? Were any of the other astronomers at Harvard interested in this?
Not to my knowledge, though I think Bart Bach, who was my thesis advisor and who was a very non-theoretical person and non-modern in those days, having been trained in the Dutch school of classical star count analysis, probably did egg me on, at least. But Whipple, I think, I approached mainly because he was one of the youngest of the faculty, probably the youngest, who was in any way interested in trying something new. I had also had, I guess, a childhood interest since I'd been a radio amateur.
Oh, yeah.
But that's, I don't know if Whipple had or not. But in any case, we paired off the way you do with a young instructor and a graduate student and tried to do this, and it was a terrible blow of an emotional kind that we couldn't because we were so sure we had.
Right.
And from then on, I refused to talk to students about MKS. I don't know what an ESU is. I just like, what is it? CGS, damn it. And I stick with that.
Right.
And now we're going to flux units now, F sub nus, and you want watts per square meter per hertz, right. And I want ergs per square centimeter per cycle per second, and I'll be darned if I'll change. No, I'm serious. It really hurt.
There may be other cases where it has too, right?
Yeah, you just feel that something that you should have known, put it another way, had we known what the units meant, we would have given up because there was nothing that would heat interstellar matter to 100,000 degrees. There was nothing. You knew that the gaseous nebulae were at 10,000 degrees. There was a time that Menzel and Baker and Leo Goldberg and Lawrence Haller were working on the problems of diffuse nebulae and planetary nebulae, and the electron temperature was always 10,000 degrees. So you couldn't ever get the center of the galaxy up hotter, and it wasn't an emission nebula anyway.
Right.
So this stuck, and the irritation stuck, and the fact is that I stayed in interstellar matter. I left Harvard and started observing with Henye, the spectra of reflection nebulae, which had something to do with my thesis, and the reflection of emission nebulae, for which the nebula spectrograph was invented by Struve and used first by Henye and myself. And with that, we found various well-known properties of the diffuse nebulae.
This is at Yerkes?
At Yerkes. And then the year or so after that, with its success at Yerkes, where it was a jury-rigged thing, Struve built this rather bigger one, which was moved to McDonald with the same optics. Mm-hmm. And with it, the H2 regions, the diffuse H2 regions, were found by Struve, LV, worked on by Strömgren.
Mm-hmm.
So the interstellar gas at 10,000 we kept finding.
Right.
This got us nowhere with the radio measures,
which is up in the millions. Yeah.
Yeah.
But let me go back a little bit. First.